are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A brilliantly researched reinvestigation into the nearly forgotten century-old murder that inspired one of the most seductive mysteries in the history of television and film. In 1908, Hazel Drew was found floating in a pond in Sand Lake, New York, beaten to death. The unsolved murder inspired rumors, speculation, ghost stories, and almost a century later, the phenomenon of Twin Peaks. Who killed Hazel Drew? Like Laura Palmer, she was a paradox of personalities, a young, beautiful puzzle with secrets. Perhaps the even trickier question is, who was Hazel Drew? Seeking escape from her poor country roots, Hazel found work as a domestic servant in the notoriously corrupt metropolis of Troy, New York. Fate derailed her plans for reinvention. But the investigation that followed her brutal murder was fraught with red herrings, wild goose chases, and unreliable witnesses. Did officials really follow the leads, or did they bury them to protect the guilty? The likely answer is revealed in an absorbing true mystery that's ingeniously reconstructed and every bit as haunting as the cultural obsession it inspired. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder at Teal's Pond, Hazel Drew and the Mystery That Inspired Twin Peaks, with my special guest journalists and authors David Bushman and Mark T. Givens. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, David Bushman and Mark T. Givens.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. That was an amazing synopsis. I feel like going out and buying the book now myself, you know.
Like a good story, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me, gentlemen. Let's start about right off with how you both came to be. What a little bit about your backgrounds, and as you say, your interest in Twin Peaks at one time. Tell us how this all came about.
Mark, why don't you go first? We'll flip it around this time.
Oh, geez, you're throwing me off. Yeah, we kind of have our...
All right, I'll go first.
I can keep it first, dude.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I think both of us were a long time, David will chime in, I'm sure, but we're a long time, as you mentioned, Twin Peaks fans. And for those who don't know, it was a show in the late 80s, early 90s that didn't last very long, only two seasons and then a movie. But was a big cult favorite, Mark Frost and David Lynch, who is, you know, kind of a cult hero, I guess, or a cult filmmaker. Anyway, we were big fans of that back in the day, and it ended abruptly. And 25 years or so later, as predicted in the show, it did come back for a third season. And I think we were both kind of rekindled our younger days or something, our interest in it. So I started a podcast in the lead up to it, looking into, you know, Twin Peaks, if you're not familiar, it's all about, you know, puzzles and illusions and layers of, within the show. So that's what I was doing in my podcast. And it started with the pilot, the first episode, which is kind of a little two-hour movie in and of itself, which is the murder mystery. And I was looking at the inspirations for David Lynch and Mark Frost and happened to wander into the Mark Frost side of things, where he had mentioned in a couple interviews over the years, one or two back 25 years ago and one or two in more recent years, I think at the USC Film Theater is one we definitely have on record, where he first mentioned the origins of this the story, the Hazel Drew story, which he would then go on to talking with David Lynch, come up with Twin Peaks, which is a sort of a parallel tale of a young, beautiful girl with all kinds of secrets and things like that. But her body's found washed on the shores of a small pond in a small town or near a small town. And then kind of the consequences of all that, all her relationships and so forth. So they're kind of parallel tales, although Mark Frost, and maybe I can transition a little bit here to David, who wrote a book with Mark Frost and can talk about some of the origins there. he didn't really know the details that we, you know, spent some time researching. He does now. He provided the foreword for our book.
Right.
But for him, it was more a ghost story that his grandmother had told him, a cautionary tale of stay away from that pond, basically. He spent summers in the area where this occurred. So that's sort of the elevator, the intro speech. I don't know, David, if you have anything to add, kind of how we got together and all that.
Good. I just from a personal perspective, I was editing TV copy at Variety, the showbiz publication at the time that Twin Peaks was first released. And, you know, we had stories about it almost every week because it was big news that David Lynch was coming to TV. That was like the first story. Then the second story was, you know, ABC just kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off because the rumors that were going around were that the executives in New York were scared of it. They didn't know how, they were afraid it was going to just totally bombed because it was, it's the word I'm looking for, different, I guess is one word. But, and so eventually, you know, they did get it on the air. And so I was editing stories about it every week. Then at one point I was proposing book ideas to a company called Hal Leonard or Applause Books. And one of the ideas we submitted was for Twin Peaks. And then after I submitted the idea and was waiting to hear from them, that's when everyone found out Twin Peaks was coming back. And so they picked Twin Peaks as the topic. And while I was researching that book, I came across Hazel Drew. And then I happened to be listening to Mark's Dear Meadow radio podcast. And he was talking about it and he was clearly really interested in it. And so was I. So I reached out to him and said, you know, would you like to co-write a book about this? And that's what happened.
Great. The first thing you talk about is the assistance that you had and your first visit to Sand Lake and the whole area. To start off, tell us about Sand Lake, and this is a small place, and its relation to Troy, and set the stage for the places that are important, the locations that are important in this story.
Well, Troy, as you mentioned in your introduction, was a notoriously corrupt city. It was also a very vibrant city around the turn of the 20th century, which is the period of time we're talking about. It had a hugely vibrant commercial place. It had people came from all over to shop there. It's largely because it's on the Hudson that it was a major transportation hub. They had a railroad station and a lot of people passed through it, servicemen and other people on their way north or south. So it was really a vibrant sort of hopping community and also a notoriously corrupt one in terms of politics, which they actually produced some of the most influential politicians of the time, people like Frank Black, who went on to be governor of New York, and this guy Murphy, who was a U.S. senator. Powerful, powerful people, but also people who were deeply enmeshed in the political machines. Black, Republican, and Murphy, a Democrat. And so, and you know, that corruption sort of filtered down into almost every aspect of life. There was a very famous incident in 1896 there where a guy by the name of Bat Shea, who was stuffing ballots for the Democrats, got confronted by a bunch of guys from the APA, which was the American Protective Association, this virulently anti-Catholic group. This is in Troy, and they were Republicans. And it led to this showdown where one of the APA guys got shot and killed, and Bat Shea got executed for that killing, even though it seems by every indication that he was not guilty of it, but that it was a politically motivated execution. So, and then Mame Fay, who was one of was a world-renowned madam, had places in downtown Troy. They had huge collar factories, the Arrow Shirt, which most of us have heard of, was produced there. Uncle Sam, the guy whom our country is named after, was from Troy. It was just a really exciting place to be. It was a big city, and but at the same time, a very kind of like a den of iniquity in a way, and it just all played into the story that we were telling. And Mark, I'll let you talk about Sand Lake.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So it was kind of the tale of two different worlds, which really helped, you know, our narrative kind of flesh things out, because Hazel was involved in both worlds. She was born out in the country near Sand Lake, where she was later found murdered. But her family kind of bounced back and forth out of economic necessity at the time. Her father had problems keeping a job. So times they're living with her mother's brother, Will, who's also involved in the story out in Sand Lake. So it's really, you know, it bounced back and forth. And Troy, as David went through in itself, was so interesting. A thing to kind of add there is that you can go there today. It's not exactly preserved. There was, to one of our friends' dismay, a lot of, in the 70s, they did take down some of the buildings there. But relatively speaking, it's really preserved today historically. So you can see, maybe not, you know, the big train station is gone, but there's other buildings around there where you can see the glass and the architecture of the time. And Kathy Sheehan and Don Rittner were two historians that helped us out a lot, showed us around the town up there. And I know, for example, there's a new series on HBO, The Gilded Age, which I believe is set in New York City, but they use Troy for a lot of the filming, which they said they've done in the past as well, just because it's kind of preserved, but a really neat place to visit, but we happened upon that. And then, as I was saying, to contrast that, out 15, 20 miles outside of Troy is Sand Lake and the surrounding countryside. And it really is a different world then and today, I think. And that, you know, we tried to put that in the book, but it's just different kinds of people, you know, a little wary of strangers, but once they know your name or whatever, they're the nicest people in the world. So many of the locals helped us there. In particular, we always have to mention Bob Moore, who's the Sand Lake historian, who primarily would set up these roundtables that allowed us to get together with like-minded people and descendants of people involved in the case, and just really great fact-finding resources. And, you know, Bob also grew up in the area and was able to point us to all kinds of different locations. He took us to where the pond was. We kind of found it all together, reconstructing it, and would introduce us to, you know, locals who, as I said, were descendants of people involved in the case. One other we should always mention is Mark Marshall, who was kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, a third collaborator with us, really, in a lot of the stuff in the book that we uncovered, what we uncovered together. And to be honest, he uncovered a lot of it, would send these great long emails that would take days and weeks to unpack because they were so full of stuff, sometimes a little stream of conscious, but a great community up there, which made this whole thing kind of fun, just research. And we lost track of really how many times we traveled up there, you know, just periodically. It would be time to go visit the library and do some more photocopies and check in with the guys and everything. And they would be uncovering, you know, new things. We were always on the lookout for the records up there. So we'd get a lead and didn't really make much hay in that regard. But Sand Lake itself, to just echo back to Twin Peaks briefly, it really felt like Twin Peaks to me. And again, Mark Frost, we think of David Lynch usually if you're familiar with Twin Peaks, but Mark Frost was half of that at least. And this was where he, you know, kind of spent some formative time. And so it's all the trees and kind of remote, and a lot of our, where the murder took place or where we think it took place was up on this Taberton Mountain, kind of this sort of murky, creepy locale, you know, just right out of a murder mystery. So yeah, very, even to this day, you go there and it's a bit timeless there in terms of the same names of the same people. But yeah, you can go see the pond where Hazel's body was found, Teal's Pond, and just different. David and I both live in different cities, but I think we both really enjoyed visiting Troy and Sand Lake and getting to know people there as well.
Even Sand Lake itself was dichotomous in the sense that you had the locals or the townies, I guess people might call them, back in the day, it was a very popular resort area, and you had a lot of wealthy people coming out from to places like Glen Lake, like Glass Lake. Teddy Roosevelt was a frequent visitor there, but they'd go to from Albany or Troy or the city, New York City, and you know, there'd be very little interaction between the locals and these tourists or these people who had summer homes there. And in fact, one of the key suspects, I would say, in our story is this guy, Henry Kramerath, who was a wealthy businessman from Albany who had they called it a camp, but it was really like a resort for wealthy people out in the woods, not far from where Hazel was found. And there were all these rumors that there were these wild sex parties going on there and women being held against their will in these parties. So even Sand Lake itself had this sort of dual identity, which was really interesting.
Let's get to what you found about the real person, not Laura Palmer, despite some similarities. But tell us what you found out about Hazel Drew and her family.
Well, Mark sort of touched on it before. She grew up in the countryside. She came from very humble background. Her father, had, like Mark said, had trouble holding a job. Her mother was partly handicapped from polio. I think she walked with a limp and a cane, and big family, a bunch of brothers and sisters who survived, and then some of whom who died very young, either in childbirth or whatever it was. But so, you know, they didn't have a lot of resources to go around. The family moved around quite a bit. When Hazel was 14, she moved out and left her family and got a job as a housekeeper or domestic servant, is what they called it at the time, right, with a man named Tom Hislop, who was a very powerful, wealthy man in Troy, who was a city treasurer and ran for mayor and did not win. But a big time politician, a big time member of the Republican Party. And he, during Hazel's time there, got involved in a rather highly publicized corruption case that resulted in there were missing city funds, and they didn't trace it back to him. They traced it back to his assistant, although there was subsequently, I think he was sued civilly, and they tried to prove, and I think they did win some money that he had oversight and that he hadn't done his job. So, and then from there she wound up with going to two other jobs before eventually quitting just like a couple of days before her death. But the other two people, also very powerful people, a very rich coal merchant, and then the city engineer who was a professor at RPI, also involved in something of a scandal. So somehow she had insinuated herself after coming from this background into a wealthy circle of employers in Troy.
What happens to her July 11th, 1908? And tell us about the subsequent investigation and the characters that arise in that investigation.
Mark?
Yeah, in July 11th, forgive me, the dates are more dated maybe, but what happened was a hazy summer day, Saturday in the afternoon, some locals from Sand Lake, their names escape me, but some teenage boys camp out in the area where this Teal's Pond is on the local farmer William Teal's property. They spend their weekends out there hunting and drinking and, you know, doing whatever they do to blow off steam. Well, Saturday, as they're walking, one of them is leaving the camp, and they had earlier seen on their way in something sort of floating in the pond, but they just took it for some refuse, some rags that had kind of bunched up together. But this time they get a better look, and he calls his friend, and together they get a local farmer they know close by and haul it in. And at first it's clearly a body. They can tell once they get it ashore and the local authorities start to show up that it is a female, but it's really hard to identify because the body, it turns out later, they find out had been in the pond for a better part of a week. And I think, as I said, it was a particularly hot summer that week, and the skin had started to blacken. The body itself was bloated, kind of beyond recognition. So that when her father eventually comes, he hears, kind of puts a few things together and thinks it could be his daughter. When he comes to identify her, he can't recognize her because of the shape the body's in. She does have gold fillings, which he remembers, and he sees those. So he thinks that's her, but it takes other family members to kind of come and see the clothes and everything, I think, eventually. So that's, you know, kind of the kicking off point. I think you also, you know, how the investigation and the initial suspects and so forth. And I say initial because if we start going through every suspect, that's kind of one of the great or interesting things about this story, is the amount of suspects. Most of them get off the hook or red herrings, but there's twists and turns. And again, the case was never solved at the time. So you have to kind of go back and look at the investigation again. So I can just lead off a couple, and then maybe David can jump in and chime in on the investigation itself. But then the last people besides, in all likelihood, the murderer or murderers, to see Hazel alive were two of these locals out in Sand Lake, Frank Smith, who's a teenager and kind of, I have to use the proper word these days, but the parlance of the time, he's basically called a bumpkin, an idiot, the town fool, pretty much by everybody. Like all the newspapers report that. We kind of speculate, I mean, if this made into the book, that maybe had a learning disability, you know, not recognized at the time, but that's how he's characterized at the time. And anyway, he's kind of the local kid running around. It turns out he did know Hazel and had a little bit of a crush on her. How much of one, you know, that plays into motive and him as a suspect. But in any event, on that Tuesday evening where it is, he and his buddy, Rudolph Gundren, who's a farmer, another local, also a charcoal burner, which is sort of this arcane method of making charcoal out there in the woods that we did learn, but it's a little hazy. We learned so much during this book. I can't remember exactly all that goes into charcoal burning. But Rudy Gundrum, the charcoal burner, another quite a character, and in all likelihood, he didn't know Hazel. We don't think he had anything to do with it. He's brought in and questioned right away, but they kind of let him go pretty soon. Whereas Frank Smith, they keep coming back to. He's a suspect they keep returning to. And in any event, they're kind of rumbling down this Taberton Mountain Tuesday evening, I want to say around 7:15, and they pass Hazel, who's completely, and again, Hazel is a 20-year-old, considered a beautiful young girl by just about everybody. We have pictures of her. She did seem quite attractive, but she's all kind of dolled up, like she's going out on a date, and she just kind of has a bit of a swagger to her, it seemed, and you know, why she's climbing a mountain as the sun's fast setting, you know, it's getting dark and it's, you know, we were up on this mountain even to this day. It's not a great place you want to be. It's a rough road and we know how she ended. But in any event, she's strolling like she's going to meet somebody for a date and just kind of says, "Hey, Frank, how's it going?" And he's, "Hey, Hazel." And that's the last anyone sees of her. And then less than a quarter of a mile where they pass, that's where that Saturday, about a week or so later, is where her body is found. So that's the kind of entryway into the investigation with your two suspects right there. And then if you've read the book, Dan, you know, it kind of goes all over the place and I could fill out the rest of the hour here on it.
Mm-hmm. There are some characters that come to light, obviously the district attorney O'Brien, and you say all of these people had definite ties to the Republican Party, which were very powerful in that area and influential. And a couple detectives that were very prominent. Maybe you can tell us about these people in law enforcement.
In terms of the investigation, just before I get to that, almost every single mystery or unsolved, unanswered, almost every single mystery about this case never was publicly answered. Whether or not it was privately answered or not, I don't know, but I can just run off a couple of them for you. This is to me why, I mean, this investigation just seemed, you know, horribly amiss to me. Hazel was very eager to go to Lake George the weekend before her death. And for some reason, she was going with her Aunt Minnie. And for some reason, they wound up going to Schenectady instead. I mean, she was eager about it to the point where she stayed at her dressmaker's till 11 o'clock the night before on Friday, waiting for the dressmaker to finish her shirt. And her dressmaker said, like, you know, I'll, you know, why don't you come by tomorrow or whatever? And it's like, no, I have to have this shirt for going to Lake George. So why did she want to go to Lake George so badly? And why did they wind up not going to Lake George? Then there's like, when they came back from Lake George, from Schenectady rather, which is where they wound up going instead, the next morning, her employer, Mrs. Carey, asks her to do the wash, the family wash, and she says no, and she quits. And according to everybody we spoke to or we read about, rather, including Mrs. Carey, that took them by surprise. She didn't have another job lined up as far as anybody knew. Her mother didn't know that she quit. Her best friend, Carrie Weaver, didn't know that she quit. Minnie, another close friend, didn't know that she quit. At least that's what Minnie said. I mean, Minnie had a real talent for not telling the truth. But so why did she quit without another job? Nobody officially knows. Why was she, where was she Monday night? We believe she was killed on Tuesday. Why? Where was she on Monday night? Nobody knows. Nobody ever stepped forward to say Hazel was with me. Almost all day Tuesday, where was she? Again, nobody stepped forward to say Hazel was with me. So it's just, and what was she, like Mark said, what was she doing dolled up? What was she doing in the Taberton Woods at 7:30 at night as dark was approaching in an area that was known to be not safe?
And how did she get to the pond?
How did she get to the pond? Did someone take her there? How was she planning? She had left her suitcase at the train station in Troy. She didn't have anything with her. How was she planning to get back to Troy to get her suitcase? None of these questions were ever satisfactorily answered. So to me, that indicates that either we were dealing with either an incredibly incompetent bunch of investigators, or we were dealing with investigators who had reason to keep some of these things secret. And you mentioned, this is an area where Mark and I may not see eye to eye, but Jarvis O'Brien was a very prominent, he was the district attorney who was leading the investigation. He was very prominent in a Republican Party politics there in Troy, and, you know, a pretty powerful guy, but deeply, deeply embedded in the party. I mean, he had worked at a law firm coming up through his professional career. He had worked with a guy who was head of the party at one point. And his top lieutenant was a guy named Duncan Kay, who was almost definitely a member of the APA, which I had mentioned to you before, and was definitely had some involvement in that melee that I talked about with Batshe in 1896, in that election where there was ballot stuffing going on, because I think he was actually a high school classmate of Shea's, but he was a member. He was coming at it from the other side. He was a member of the APA. He was in the crowd of Republicans who confronted the ballot stuffers. So, and then, you know, we found other connections like that too, and it just seemed like These two components together had us wondering what was really going on.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to the latest research, 90% of employers plan to make enhancing the employee experience a top priority in 2022. After all, a happy workplace is key to attracting and keeping great employees. A few ways employers can make their employees happier is to make them feel more valued, offering them, for example, more learning opportunities and allowing for more flexibility in their individual work schedules. And if you need to add more employees to your team, there's ZipRecruiter. Their matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated hiring site in the U.S. based on G2 ratings. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. Try it for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, David and Mark, we were talking about the investigation so far. The O'Brien and his detectives focused on and spoke to numerous times and thought there was something amiss, speaking to Minnie Taylor and also William Taylor, the uncle of Hazel. Tell us a little bit more about what the uncle had to say and some of the beyond bizarre behavior that he exhibited after Hazel was discovered, before we talk about the media and its influence and its behavior.
Okay.
Go ahead, David. I know you're...
Well, Hazel came from a very strange family. I think there's no question about that. I mean, like I said, the mother was considered, if you believe the press, very cold. The father was considered something of a ne'er-do-well. And Minnie was this sort of irascible, cantankerous woman who was constantly withholding secret or withholding information from police refusing to cooperate and saying things like, I can't tell you that because I don't want to get Hazel's friends in trouble, and barking at the press to leave her alone. And Minnie had information that she was not releasing. So there was Minnie and supposedly very close to Hazel. And I mean, like very close, a traveling companion. And even though there were like 20 years age difference, they were very close. And, you know, nobody had reported Hazel, even though Minnie supposedly saw Hazel, a couple of times a week, as I recall, nobody reported Hazel missing. She was last seen on Tuesday, as Mark said, on the mountain. They found her body on Saturday. Nobody reported her missing. Minnie said Minnie saw her on Monday, so the day before she was last seen, and said that right after Hazel had quit her job, went directly to Minnie to drop some stuff off. Minnie insisted that she didn't know that Hazel had quit her job, which, you know, is possible because Hazel kept secrets, but or else it's not possible because Minnie kept secrets. So you don't know. So that's Minnie. She was like not cooperative. She was withholding information, and she was a very sort of cantankerous, unpleasant woman. We talked to one of her descendants who said that nobody in the family, who actually remembered Minnie from when she was a very little girl. She said nobody in the family looked forward to Minnie's visits because she was a real busybody who got involved in everybody's life. And the children were told when Aunt Minnie was coming over, they were told never beat Aunt Minnie at dominoes, always let Aunt Minnie win. So a character. William Taylor was, Minnie was the sister of Hazel's mother, Julia. William was their, William Taylor was their brother, and he was another character. And his farmhouse was very close to the pond. And so for a while, they thought that she was there going to visit her uncle, but it turns out that she did not have any kind of relationship with her uncle. As in fact, nobody did. The guy had no friends and, was a very socially awkward, unpleasant person. So they pretty much ruled that out. But Mark, I know you like talking about William Tell, so I'll let you dive deeper into him.
Yeah, he's another good character. Him and Minnie, as David said, Hazel had kind of these strange characters in her family tree. But yeah, the chief suspicion upon him, and he was kind of with Frank Smith, really the two out in Sand Lake that the investigators kept going back to. They'd invest, you know, they'd drill them, and then a day or two later, after some other leads had dried up or something else had turned up, they would return and drill him again. But yeah, he's this cranky older guy. He was a widower at the time, and reportedly at one point had attempted suicide. I think it was after his wife had died. He was prone to bouts of melancholy. Then the night Hazel's, you know, they're drilling him again and again and asking these questions, trying to get him to crack. And all he would say the night, he didn't have an alibi, but the night of the murder, he just said he was out on his porch smoking all night by himself, and he just wouldn't change his story.
Right.
There were some questions. I think this was maybe drummed up by the press about his relationship with Hazel. But then again, he did seem kind of like a weird guy. I don't know. There was some weird quote about he wasn't, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there was a little bit of a question. I guess, you know, sometimes the press is backing in to look for a motivation. So yeah, he's a great character. Just to kind of plug this little part of the book, the way we ended up writing it, you know, when we happened upon this case and did all the research and had all this great story kind of lay it out in front of us, was how to present it. And we went back and forth. I think David and I had different visions at first, and we kind of came up with a hybrid approach. But as part of that, if you remember, Dan, just kind of randomly throughout, and we tried to kind of use them to pep the story up, or just because we liked the little scenes. But it's called creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So everything, you know, is based on, we were, you know, our publishers really took us to task on the fact checking. But we would create these scenes that we knew happened, and we might even have some of the dialogue reported out in the press.
Right.
Because if this was the time, and we get into that a little bit too, the press, but was, you know, kind of blossoming, or, you know, the tabloids and everything was happening at that time. They were for the first time using photographs and all that. So it was kind of becoming a whole thing. And sorry, I lost my train of thought there. Oh, but for the creative nonfiction, we would put these little scenes in and characters like Minnie and Uncle Will, because, you know, we got to know them through the reporting at the time, talking to their ancestors, you get more color attached to them, and just knowing the background and everything. We could put these little scenes in, like the investigators going out to the farmhouse to meet William Taylor. And, you know, they got a kind of a rough, you know, a rude awakening when they knocked on the door. So that kind of, we tried to also bring the investigation alive, you know, that we were undergoing, and exploring these kinds of things and uncovering was part of that. So yeah, those of her family and sort of suspicious characters, as David kind of outlined Minnie, we don't seriously think that Minnie was a suspect, at least in our eyes. And we definitely didn't see anything that the police held her as a suspect, but always that she wasn't telling everything and just a busybody and a gossip, but kind of wanted to control the gossip for herself. So yeah, that was a big part of the story, the characters, that not just Hazel herself, but just, you know, back to Twin Peaks, which I don't always want to do, but that's how Twin Peaks starts. You know, the main character, Laura, is dead. Now you meet her family and meet her friends and her enemies and all that. So definitely a big part of our story too.
And just to piggyback on William, and then I unfortunately got a run, but he had early indications that the dead body that they found at the pond was Hazel. And one, he didn't go down to he never went to the undertaker to confirm it. He had this because he was told by Frank Smith's father, actually, that Frank was pretty sure it was Hazel. And he never went down to identify it. He never went down to check on to see whether it was in fact his niece. He never called his sister or notified his sister that her daughter might be dead. He supposedly, they asked him like what he did that day. And he said he went into town to get his hair cut. You know, this is right after he's told that in all probability his sister's daughter, who's like 20 years old, was murdered in his backyard, essentially. And not only did he go to get a haircut, but he went to a hotel that had a phone, and he could have called and let his sister know, but he didn't.
Wow.
So there was also like really weird behavior on his part. And he, like Mark said, he did not have an alibi. His people who lived the ranch, the farmhands who lived with him, were out that night in town in Sand Lake and in Avril Park. He claimed that after he smoked his pipe, he went to bed. So and then when his farmhands came home that night, they didn't see him. You know, they the next morning he said, you know, I was sleeping. So he had no alibi. And, you know, he was there. And plus, I know this is another topic that Mark really likes to talk about, and it's a good point. They were really focused on him for a while. And the people up in Taberton and Sand Lake were really convinced that the investigators were going to try to pin this murder on somebody from that area rather than somebody from Troy, because there was this whole, I was talking before about the dichotomy between the tourists and the locals, and that existed. There was this resentment of these wealthier people who were coming in from Troy and leading this investigation and asking all these questions about their neighbors and stuff. And Taylor was weird, but he was one of them, you know? And so I think that they kind of rallied around him in a way. So, but, you know, he's definitely a suspect.
Definitely. Their behavior complicated the case immeasurably, certainly, Minnie and William.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, guys. So I've got to, at this point, unfortunately, I wish I could stay and talk some more, but I've got to run. But Dan, you're in great hands with Mark.
Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you reaching out, and it was a great conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
So Mark, we have what I had asked was, and this is a big part of this book, we talk about yellow journalism and the state of journalism at that time, but also a very fascinating character comes into play named Clemens, claiming to be this master criminologist, and also has his fingers in the media as well. So if you could tell us what was the influence of the media even before this Clemens comes into Troy and wields his influence, or tries to.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So just to take a step back, I guess I would say, in a way, not maybe level of effort or energy, but our research into this was kind of in two distinct phases. And the first was establishing the facts, of the investigation at the time. So that was just pouring through every newspaper we could find at the time. And it was extensively covered coast to coast. It was in the New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, headline kind of stuff for about 2.5 weeks, I guess. So it was almost like, in the fact gathering stage, you're getting different versions, almost like the different gospels.
Right.
Each, sometimes the facts didn't quite add up. So in that first phase, it was just gathering as much as we could. Anytime you find a new source, it would have a lot, 80, 90% of the same thing, but it would just have some new, quotes or facts, or some wouldn't be completely relevant to the investigation, but it's just, for the story and everything. So yeah, it was. And then as we kind of, all right, now we have the basic facts, what happened in the 2.5 weeks, who were the big suspects. We're looking at, a couple of things. There's inconsistencies. So, you just start to naturally go through the papers and, well, all right, the New York Times, not to get political or anything but that, but you kind of assume that's a trusted source in 1908.
Right.
And so you kind of start from there and you start to see differences in reporting that became really relevant in the solution, actually. And we don't like to kind of talk about that for those who haven't gotten through the book yet. But we started to see, I think David alluded to, for example, and this is, we're not being partisan at all here. For one thing, politics of the time were completely different to the modern day.
Sure.
But it just so happened the investigators were all Republicans at the time. And that was because they were from the county, which the Republicans controlled, whereas the city of Troy was controlled by the Democrats. So it was just at that time, back and forth. And oh man, we got into a lot of research because a lot of our characters, three of Hazel's employees, as David said, were Republican employees. Republican officials. Two had run for mayor. One was a city treasurer while Hazel was there. So you can go back and look at the press of 1908, so not just following the investigation, but you can go look at the elections and get a better sense of these people. And I think David said we found scandals that were going on at the time, thinking about motivations, what Hazel might have come across. So anyway, yeah, we had to kind of almost take a step back and consider our sources and say, and do a deep dive. The more we found out about Troy, how everything was politics, you wanted to get a job, then you had to be in the right party to, blah, blah, blah. And same with the newspapers. The newspapers were affiliated with either Democrats or Republicans. So we did, and again, not to give away too much, but when you get closer to the solution, Republican-owned papers, and again, not a partisan statement, this is 1908, completely different Republican Party, but they were certain things they did not report that the other papers just did. And some of those were pretty significant and led us to what we think of as at least partial of the solution. There was also, and Dave is right, I kind of went deep on this because it became sort of necessary for the solution to kind of understand the sources. But you would also have the difference between the local Troy papers and the tabloids from New York, who were more sensational and making things that, just weren't true. The names are wrong, right, and things sure, like that. But at the same time, they would turn things up that were relevant to the case, and you'd kind of have to verify it independently. So I think you also, had alluded to one of the characters who kind of epitomizes, we put him in there front and center in one of the chapters because he epitomizes all those things I was just talking about, the sort of yellow journalism at the time, and the reporter being part of the story. This guy, William Clemens, shows up in town, a few days into the investigation. He's reporting for the New York World, which I'm a little rusty. I think William Hearst there was two kind of big newspaper magnates at the time. And one of those Clemens kind of reported to, not personally, it was Citizen Kane. You know what I'm talking about, a little bit of that history. But anyway, he bursts into town. He's billed as, he reports for the New York World, but he bills himself as the world's greatest criminologist. He has no training in this matter or anything like that. Just quite a character, though. You know, he seemed like he had a lot of energy. I mean, I kind of did a deep dive on him. Just his life isn't, you know, he's in all kinds of different pots. This was just a brief sort of era for him. But he shows up in town and somehow he inveigles his way. Initially, he's there with the, embedded with the investigators. Like another paper mentions him, you know, oh, famed William Clemens has joined the investigators. And then two or three days later, he finally comes out with his first reports. And it's, you know, this big bombshell that basically slams the investigation for being incompetent. And then in the press, back and forth, him and Jarvis O'Brien kind of trading shots back and forth, you know, just taking cheap shots at each other. Clemens basically saying you should be solving this, and O'Brien defending himself, and, you know, two-bit out of state reporter or out of the area kind of thing. So he comes in and very flamboyant, and he's going to solve it and all this. And he does, again, like, you kind of have to fact check him when he's making these claims. Like, sure. why is this not in any of the other reports? And some of it you kind of discredit. And then there's other things. In particular, he was the first, maybe one of the only, to point out this period, the winter before Hazel died. She died in the summer. So this was winter 1907.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She spent a mysterious, I think it was 2 weeks. But at that uncle that we spoke about, the kind of creepy uncle, Will Taylor, she was there with a mysterious illness. Her brother's wife attended to her. Uncle Will kind of let it be. And when they asked him about it, he said he didn't even know what the illness was. But there were theories, and Clemens kind of put forth that she had gotten herself pregnant, you know, was pregnant and was either there having an abortion or having a baby and something like that. Now, there's no any other proof of anything. We included in the story, but there's no proof of any of that. Clemens, that's kind of one of his final accusations that he throws out there. And then he just kind of disappears before the end, the inquest near the end of the month, which kind of wraps up the investigation. And he's off to, you know, like I said, I did some more research on him. He's solving some other case down the road, some spy thriller or something like that. But yeah, just a very interesting character. A lot of characters like that in here that are, you know, potential wormholes that, you know, you're not writing about the life of William Clemens right now, but definitely helped, I think, you know, kind of keep the story interesting and going.
Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about the inquest. This investigation, you take and detail this. It's a fairly short investigation with lots of events and characters like this Clemens coming into the story. But what does O'Brien really want to do with this inquiry that he can't get through the investigation or the inquest, pardon me?
Yeah, and that's you're reading all out of this secondhand in the different press accounts. So we're a little curious about that too. Nothing, you know, it's kind of built up actually for the weeks of the investigation. There's pressure on him when things are stalling or someone's a hot suspect to some kind of arrest, or they start calling for the inquest when there's no, you know, sort of definite suspect. And my memory is O'Brien's resistant to it for a while because you know, that's what ended up happening. Nothing really came of it. I think they, again, so David's not here. He did get his comments in before he left, but me and we did disagree on some things. And O'Brien, as an investigator and how effective he was, I was a little more generous or charitable with O'Brien's effort. Obviously, it did go unsolved. But I think David, at least at the start, you know, he might have been accusing O'Brien of being the murderer at one point. I can't remember. So we kind of had to compromise on that. But I did have a more favorable opinion of, you know, David said he didn't solve it. And at the end of it, he didn't. But that does happen at times. And, you know, even after all these years, you know, have we solved it? You know, so with all the internet resources we have. But they did, it was kind of the grand finale. They, after all the suspects had been brought in, different theories and gossip in the press, near the end of the month, they ended up having a two-day inquest. And I think at the end, I think, like I said, O'Brien kind of kept pushing it off. I think they had felt like they had investigated all the leads they had, and the idea was to get everybody back in the room, in the public, and try one last ditch effort to force out something new. But reportedly, the questioning, you know, it was the same old questions. Basically, there may have been one or two little hiccups, but nothing really came of it. They did a day in Sand Lake and a day in Troy, I think. So again, kind of divided the different characters. And then after that, the coroner, who, you know, mysteriously somehow officially sat over this, but I think in name only, presided over the inquest, not O'Brien, but he issued his final report, which is basically, you know, she was killed with a blow to the back of the head by persons and methods unknown. And that was the end of July. And then, like I said, there was a plethora of reporting for 2.5 weeks. And then come August, it's like, you know, just fell off the face of the earth. There's one or two mentions you can find about, I think there was about 2 weeks after the inquest, there's a couple of reports of this young man returning, prominent young man returning to Troy, and allegedly there were some letters or something connected into Hazel. But there's like a report of that, and then again, nothing goes blank after that. So yeah, the inquest in the end, it's kind of like, you know, it fits the end of the investigation, the big dramatic reveal, but it was a complete bust, fortunately, and just kind of went out with a whimper.
We won't give your, as you say, the solution or your conclusions away, but you did think there, you do write that you and Mark, pardon me, you and David felt that there was an angle somehow missed in this, maybe even a piece of vital evidence overlooked. What, again, I don't want to give anything away, but what was your idea in terms of the mistakes made, at least in this investigation, that were obvious to you, the missteps?
Yeah. And again, David might give you a different answer in terms of the mistakes. And I don't want to give too much away, but I thought, you know, on the whole, the investigation was fairly thorough. There was all kinds of rumors and gossips, and, you know, they found a chest of letters with people's initials on it at one point. But there was a lot of smoke and no real fire at the end of the day. Except, as you said, there was one angle. We don't, I guess, need to get into it because it's near the end of the book and it's important. But that just seemed mysteriously to not be followed up on thoroughly. I mentioned some of the papers covering certain things. And again, the investigators were aligned to a certain political party as well, the Republican Party at the time. So yeah, there are hints of a cover-up and a conspiracy if you're interested in that kind of thing. I think it's, you know, what we uncovered is legit. And I would say the reason is, you know, where we were doing this, looking into this for 6 or 7 years, and the first couple of years we're looking at this, the solution that we're kind of alluding to here, it was not on my radar at all. Mm-hmm. And I pretty much discounted it when I mentioned David and one of our sort of collaborators up in St. Lake, Mark Marshall. He was the one kind of throwing this sort of political conspiracy angle. And in my mind is like, you guys are just dreaming. Yeah, that sounds cool. But he would, you know, and then I started looking into it, and we would uncover, you know, it's all in the book there, the things that we uncovered that just don't add up. You know, you might let one or two of them go, but there's definitely a pattern there that's our solution, basically, that leads us to that. So it wasn't us coming in with pet theories. I can only really think of one other suspect that I considered. I can't think, you know, like, we considered them all, but as we were researching, and maybe as like getting, you know, a couple of years into this, I'm like, all right, we probably need a theory or a suspect here. So there was one other one I was considering, because there was a couple of, you know, unanswered questions. But we really just tried to, you know, fact find and keep an open mind the whole time. I don't think David really ever had a serious pet theory other than what we came up with in the end.
When you talk about Hazel Drew, though, and you talk about at the time that prostitution was illegal, but it happened and people looked the other way. And you say at that time that maybe somebody could turn a trick for up to $50, whereas they would work for $20 or $30 per week. Mm-hmm. And you say that some people led secret lives and did some prostitution when the need arose, whereas they held down regular jobs. I don't want to give anything away, but in this investigation, who was Hazel Drew, and how could she afford the vacations, the trips, the expensive clothing? How could she do that? As one of her girlfriends asked, how could she manage that?
Yeah, that was definitely a question in the air and something we had to consider. And you're thinking about motive and you start, you know, putting two and two together. I will say, you know, getting back to the press and yellow journals, they pushed that angle at different times, you know, quoting her friend that you just did, which could have been an innocent aside. And again, this could be an area that David and Mark and the other Mark Marshall and others maybe have different ideas of Hazel herself, which really is the central question to the mystery when you can't figure out motive and all that. It's like, well, what was she doing?
Yeah.
So you're just trying to figure out, get in her mind. And, you know, we all looked at it and to varying degrees have a kind of image or perception of Hazel. And I can just speak for me personally is I don't see that the prostitute thing at all. She was an outgoing, sociable young woman. Everyone said that. Everyone seemed to love her. None of her family or friends alluded to anything like that. She worked as a domestic servant all day long from the age of 14 to 20. So she's there, you know, sometimes taking care of kids and stuff. I don't know if she would have been able. It's possible, but that's a lot, you know, that's a lot for someone to also be on the side. I guess it doesn't take that long if you want to be a prostitute, but I didn't see any tangible evidence of that. Now, circumstantial, I just said, you know, she's young, outgoing. She does seemingly have clothes, you know, does these trips. But that's, if you read the newspaper accounts, they'll hype that thing up. I spoke to a historian up there in Troy, Kathy Sheehan. She said, you know, trips at the time, that's what young people did. You know, that's something cheap they could do, actually. You know, you hop on a trolley, you find a YMCA, or you have a friend, and you don't have to spend money, really. You know, you can go see the sites in Boston or whatever. So I can't answer, you know, there's definitely room for speculation there. And you're right, it's included in the book. But I personally didn't see that side of Hazel.
It is just fascinating, just the role of the media in this story and in this inquest and in the investigation itself. Like you say, different newspapers had different theories, and in the big cities, they took much more liberty with the facts. And so sensationalism was an understatement in these stories that appeared.
Definitely. Absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for talking about this murder at Teal's Pond, Hazel Drew and the mystery that inspired Twin Peaks. Can you tell our audience when this book is to be released and any Facebook page or website set up for this?
Yes. So the book is out there now in hardback, paperback, and audio. You can order it at your favorite online seller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Check bookstores. You might have to get them to order it. But it's been out for a month or two. In terms of websites or Facebook, David does have I think it's called Hazel Drew, The Real Story, that he maintains. As I mentioned earlier, I kind of started into all this through a podcast that I do called Dear Meadow Radio. It was really about Twin Peaks. I have been thinking about and threatening of reviving Dear Meadow Radio because as we did this investigation and we literally had dozens and dozens of interviews with historians, these roundtables I mentioned with descendants of the people involved in the case, and just all kinds of interesting conversations. So Dear Meadow Radio, I keep threatening to one day bring back in sort of a new form with these format for these new this kind of catalog of conversations that would, you know, sort of support the story. You know, in some cases, the roundtable gets a little off track and but to me, it's you're getting color and character and all that. So
absolutely.
I think they're really good. So yeah, look for that. Dear Meadow Radio, and you can go point your thing now. There is an episode on Hazel Drew that was done many years ago and is probably completely inaccurate. But for me, Dear Meadow Radio is there's a Facebook page, there's a Twitter handle, and again, the podcast if you're on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mark T. Givens, Murder at Teal's Pond, Hazel Drew and the Mystery that Inspired Twin Peaks. It's been a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Mark T. Givens.
And thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.